You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. It's the middle of July and it is gorgeous. Actually, it's not as hot as I was expecting it to be. What's our average high today?
91 to 92 would be average high in the month of July here in the Sacramento Valley. And listen, folks, our high today, okay, thanks to a listener a long time ago who reminded us at the start of the show, we need to mention the date so that yes. People know if it's a current show or a rerun. This is a current show. Today's date is July 16, 2025. We're preparing the show for broadcast on July 17, 2025. July 16, we're going up to a high of 81 degrees. Yes, you heard that right. 81 degrees on July 16th, 2025. That's several degrees cooler than average for this time of year, to put it mildly. Tonight's low, and this has been the interesting part. This will come up again, I believe, as we respond to one of the email questions we got. Tonight's low is going to be 53 degrees. Typical low at this time of year is closer to 60. Thursday, the day of the broadcast, will be sunny. That's the only time I'll say that, because that's true all the way through. Sunny, 86 degrees. Again, 86 degrees, July 17th. Thursday night, 54 degrees. Friday, 89 degrees. Friday night, 53 degrees. Saturday, 89 degrees. Saturday night, 54 degrees. Sunday, ooh, warming up, 90. Sunday night, 55 degrees. Monday, 84. Monday night, 53. Tuesday, 83. This is, I can say without hesitation, the coolest, mildest July I have ever experienced. And I've been here since 1974. We're not complaining, folks, but it is having some interesting effects on plants. Those tropical heat-loving plants are lagging a little bit. So in fact, as the Weather Service says, temperatures begin a cooling trend today and Wednesday to near normal temperatures, with below normal temperatures in areas adjacent to the Delta. Smoke has been a factor in the valley because of fires further up north in the valley. Southerly winds will help clear that mostly out of the Sacramento Valley, but it could back in during the nighttime. Locally breezy northerly flow in the northern and central Sacramento Valley and adjacent terrain may allow the smoke from that green fire further north into the valley, mainly in the overnight through morning time frame, but strong Delta breeze influence for the next week. Lovely planting weather. We don't really hear very many people complaining right now. Interesting conversations have we actually hit 100 degrees this year? And indeed, according to the National Weather Service, 3 or 4 days ago, we did hit 100 degrees, just barely. 2 days, 101. 2 days, I think it was, once maybe. Interestingly, the Simis weather station, which I've been using because it's just so much more detailed for weather data, ET rates and humidity and things like that, has not actually hit 100 degrees yet. July 16th has not hit 100 degrees at the official Simis weather station west of town. But the day that we did to get to 100, 101, 102, people in Woodland told me they clearly got that high, and the Weather Service said. So yeah, two or three times over 100 so far this year. Last year in July, by the 15th, we'd already had 8 or 10 days over 100, and it was a very, very hot month. So that obviously has some impact. All of that, very hot, very mild, all has some impact on how plants are performing, particularly your summer vegetables and some of your flowers. We'll certainly talk about that. It does, however, doesn't mean you can stop watering or anything like that. It's mild, but the ET rate, the rate at which plants, the model rate at which plants use water, which you then adjust for the particular species, is running 0.27 to 0.28 inches per day. So a little more than a quarter inch a day, all fairly average. The entire month of July, it's been anywhere from 0.25 to 0.29, with an average of about 0.27, 0.28 for those of you who are into that kind of thing. So for scheduling your irrigation, we're running close to 2 inches per week, measured ET rate. But I do want people to understand that milder temperatures don't mean that you can back way off on the watering. To summarize the conversation I've had probably several times a day now, with a couple of deep soakings a week rather than a lot of shallow waterings a week would be way better if you could give trees deeper waterings. How many times have we talked about that, Lois? I think we can just move on. KRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from folks like you to keep us on the air. So if you like what you hear, if you like all the great programming here at KDRT, just head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. And you'll find all kinds of cool programming when you get there.
Well, we have one that I had not heard about before. I'm going to have to go look this up. This is Dr. Ulfat Shaikh, who is hosting Mapping Healthcare and exploring the ways to improve healthcare quality and access around the globe. Dr. Shaikh is a UC Davis pediatrician, medical educator, and researcher. She's also chair of the American Academy of Pediatric Council on Quality Improvement and Patient Safety. Boy, that's a mouthful. And is on the board of the National Society of Quality in Healthcare. So tune in Fridays at 5:30 p.m. at KDRT to listen to Mapping Healthcare.
And all programs like that, which we call public affairs programs, are archived forever at kdrt.org, just as the Davis Garden Show is. And so you can just scroll back through about 15 of these, and here's an example of caring for home care workers in Nigeria. Decoding patient safety data in Denmark. I mean, this is an internationally focused program with lots of interesting topics. So if you're interested in healthcare at all, head on over and check out. You can listen to them right on your radio. You can click on the RSS feed and have it download onto your computer, or you can listen to it live Fridays, 5:30 to 6 p.m. right here at KDRT.
So, Don, we have always announced events that are happening, and a certain day, this sale and this. Well, today, I want to talk about the Master Gardeners ongoing classes. These are things that don't happen just once. They're like the second Saturday of every month, there is a class called Gardening for Year-Round Meals. And this is a hands-on class held at the Grace Garden, which is at Davis United Methodist Church, and the second Saturday of every month. And wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to do?
Yeah, in the Yolo County Library, the UC Master Gardener series, there's a Zoom format discussion series so you can attend from your kitchen table, held from 3 to 4 p.m. on the second and fourth Thursdays of each month.
The next one is Kitchen Garden Chats. I love this idea. Virtual chats from 10 to 11 a.m. on the first Saturday of every month. And I believe that's also a Zoom.
And they have help desks that are staffed by master gardeners every Saturday at the Davis and Woodland Farmers Markets. And then they are doing question and answer desks. They've done these for years. We actually had them at our nursery once, and it was lots of fun. More commonly, these are at home improvement stores, and they do them. The Yolo County Master Gardeners are doing a question and answers desk at Lowe's in West Sacramento from 10 a.m. to noon on the first and third Saturdays of each month. And I'm going to editorialize here. I think this is one of the best things the Master Gardeners can do, is sit outside of a do-it-yourself home improvement emporium like Lowe's or Home Depot and answer gardening questions, because those places sell a ton of stuff in our industry. Seriously, I've seen data on, the percentage of sales at independent garden centers, home improvement chains, and then hardware stores, like say Davis Ace, which would be in that category. It's always been true, about 40, 40, 20. It's about 40% of people buy their plants and supplies at independent garden centers like mine. About 40% go to those do-it-yourself places like Home Depot, Lowe's. There used to be a lot of chains in that category, Lumberjack, some of the others. And about 20% go to their local hardware store, which is usually locally owned. So there's a lot of people going in with pest and disease problems to stores which, no criticism intended, probably don't have staff that are trained on those issues. It's really great to have someone sitting out front who can give Let's see, what's the term? They have no financial stake in it. They're going to give answers that are based on information they got from cooperative extension speakers or experts in different fields. And so they're doing a real public service. So I just want to toss that one out there. Question and answers desk at Lowe's in West Sacramento, 10 a.m. to noon on the first and third Saturdays of the month.
And if none of those work for you, they also have a hotline. The Master Gardener hotline for Yolo County is 530-666-8737. So if you have a garden question and you can't get to one of those places, you can phone them. Or better yet, you can email them at mgyolo@ucdavis.edu. That way you can send pictures along with your message. And if you want to email us, Don, how did they reach us?
Well, you can send pictures and questions to davisgardenshow@gmail.com. Okay, we have lots of questions today. Go ahead. What have you got there, Lois?
We do. And I'm going to start with the questions I'm supposed to ask you every week. What are you harvesting now? What are you planting now? And what problems have you seen? And I want this really short. We have lots of questions. Really short.
Lots of people coming in do want last minute summer vegetables. And we do have things like tomatoes and peppers and cucumbers and squash. That's kind of where we're at with the summer vegetables. You can plant those things. You can, of course, plant basil all through the summer, and kitchen herbs can go in all the time. So that's a nice little area for, you know, if you've got a little corner of your vegetable garden, some space, go ahead and do that. We're pivoting. We are starting seeds of Brussels sprouts and the larger, older types of cauliflower and Romanesco broccoli, for example. We start them in our little greenhouse there in mid-July. So that's going in now. More fun topic is what's being harvested now. And in the month of July, yeah, it's a very, very active harvest time. If you've got a family orchard, you already know this. Folks are harvesting cherries, blackberries, caneberries are finishing up at this point. A lot of nectarines and peaches beginning to come in. July is when the early peaches and nectarines ripen. And I'm picking, my nectarines and my nectar plums are all ripening this week as we speak. There are plums that can ripen anytime from late May through September, but right now is a very active period for harvesting plums. Santa Rosa are still being picked. Flavor Supreme Pluot is coming in. Then we really get into heavy harvest on many of those things late July and into August, when most of the nectarines and some of the very best peaches, I say that with considerable care because I know you all have your favorite peach variety, but the most flavorful peaches, O. Henry, Rio Oso Gem, both ripen in August. So if you didn't leave room for them in your backyard, make some space for one of those too. O. Henry, a Rio Oso Gem, extremely intensely flavored peaches. That's enough for today's what we're doing, what we're eating, what we're planting. What are we talking about? Watering, 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 and some summer aphids and some cottony cushion scale and a few other problems like that. But that's enough for now.
I actually have a question that isn't on our little list, so I'll just pop it in here and surprise you. I have Alstroemeria, beautiful plant.
Oh, yeah.
It's the Peruvian lily, a wonderful plant. And the flowers are now done mostly, but the things that are at the end of the stem of the stalk, they don't look like seeds. Do Alstroemeria actually make seeds?
They make pod-like structures, and there are seeds in there, yeah. Yeah, so there's
really
things, yeah.
Are there some that don't? Because I've been looking, I don't see
that's any. Yes, there are some. There's a lot of new hybrid Alstroemerias that have come on the market. Some great garden plants, by the way, just amazing. These are, if you aren't familiar with Peruvian lily, it's one of the easiest perennials to grow. It blooms starting in May typically, and the blooms continue to initiate and bloom nicely through June. One big advantage of Alstroemeria, one of the reasons it's incredibly popular with florists and people who do cut flower arrangements, is the bloom itself will last for 10 to 12 days. And so I have Alstroemeria out there looking very good that started opening 2 weeks ago. This is their last bloom on those, the old-fashioned types. But if you're going into nurseries and garden centers and hardware stores right now, you're seeing a lot of dwarf Alstroemerias. And these are rather complex hybrids of different species. They continue to initiate blooms longer. They bloom for a much longer period. They can start as early as April from our growers, and they can bloom all the way through August. And I've even had the same grower sending them out in the fall in bloom. So they appear to be more robust with respect to initiating bloom. And more to the point from a gardening standpoint, they're not as rampant. They don't spread as much. They're tight little plants. They do have rhizomes. Alstroemeria spread by rhizomes, as irises do, if you're trying to visualize it. So the old-fashioned ones that we all planted in the 1980s and into the early 90s would spread considerably. I have a clump of dusky maiden that's about 10 feet across from a single plant. And out front at our garden center, same thing. They spread through the entire front of the garden border out there. We pull them out periodically and then just let them recolonize. The newer ones are well-mannered little plants. They get a couple feet across over, say, 3 years. They bloom for a very long time. They don't appear to set the pods that you're mentioning from some of the older types. So there is some variation as far as that goes. But the biggest variation is with respect to garden performance. And these newer types, stems are too short to cut for most people. I mean, they're only like 12-inch stems, but they are really much more manageable plants. They even grow well in containers. And I wouldn't really have said that about the old-fashioned types that are so floppy. So you've got a lot of choices in the world of Peruvian lilies. And this is when they're kind of at their end of their peak of bloom for the old-fashioned kinds, but the newer ones do keep on going. And there is, by the way, there's a species out there that you can sometimes find at garden centers. One of my favorites. It's got a green and red flower. It is a big, tall plant. It has migrated all through my shade border. It's in various places and pops up. It's one of these plants that pops its flowers up through other plants. So it looks like the Nandina is blooming. You know, it's gone through it, under it, and now the bloom comes out the top. It has a really interesting flower. I say green and red stripe. Hummingbirds absolutely love it, and it reseeds. So it's one that
Good.
will naturalize for you, to use the term that we like to use in the nursery industry, naturalizes readily. So it's an interesting one that you'll find out there occasionally at the kind of garden center that sells offbeat plants.
Okay, now that's so now I have two questions, not just one.
And we weren't even going to talk about alstroemerias.
In the old bed that is the pink one, and they're tall. They're as tall as the bird bath, and so they've done blooming. The stalks are kind of falling over or whatever. I was thinking I'll just go out and clean that up. Now, do I have to worry about pulling out the stems? I mean, will the thing on the roots come with it, or do I just cut them off? Or what do I do with them?
Interestingly, I remember the advice we were supposed to give when we first sold alstroemerias, which was that you're supposed
Yes.
to carefully tug them off as you did with your Agapanthus blooms when they were done, right? Pull and twist to break them rather than cutting them for some reason. I guess they were going to rot if we cut them. Well, first of all, we never found that to be a problem. Just cutting them worked just fine. The rhizomes of alstroemerias are surprisingly fragile considering what a rambunctious plant it is. I tried ordering rhizomes once because I thought we'll grow our own. And these things came in and they were smaller than a pencil thickness, and they were so fragile they were falling apart in our hands as we were just pulling them out of the box. They were very breakable, but tugging out the old stem does no harm that I have ever been able to discern. Moreover, with some of my older plantings that have spread so freely, we got to the point where we were literally mowing them after the season was done, because I was already mowing weeds in that area, and I looked down and thought, "The heck with it, we'll see what happens." Mowed them, they came back just fine. So you're probably not going to hurt an old-fashioned, vigorous alstroemeria by just cutting it, by pulling it, by mowing it, whatever. At one point, my kid got irritated, took a stick, and just whacked them to the ground because they were on the path. And I said, "Why did you do that? You've ruined them." And then we pulled all that stuff away, and they popped right back up. So once again, dad was wrong, kid was right. You probably
So
can't
my
hurt them.
the rhizomes on mine are not fragile little things. They're about peanut size and they're round and they're juicy. If they're loosely attached to the stem and I can pull the stem off, that'll be wonderful. So
Absolutely
then
fine.
I went, oh yeah, second question, that red and green one, which I didn't know existed until it popped up in my yard last year, and this year there's like three or four of them. What happens if they're droughted? In other words, the sprinkler broke, that section didn't get any water for months. Will they come back next year from the rhizomes?
Almost for sure. Geophytes, that's their big advantage. And a rhizome is a type of geophyte, like a bulb. So it's storing enough moisture. And if you, as you say, they're, bigger than I was describing, it's almost a certainty that they will simply go dormant. wait for water, come back up. I wouldn't say, I don't tout alstroemerias as being drought tolerant in the sense of going into low water landscapes. They don't look real good if you do
Yeah,
that,
I don't look
but they
good.
can
Yeah.
tolerate drought for sure with no problem. Now, I want to mention one thing about alstroemerias. They're expensive. The new hybrids are like at least half again more expensive than the older types. They're patented, they're trademark names. There's all this marketing going on with them. But you know what? If you want to grow alstroemerias and you want to, you're a frugal person and you want to just do it on a budget and you're mainly wanting to grow them for cut flowers, you can grow the LIG2 hybrids from seed. It's very, very easy to do. The LIG2 hybrids were the first alstroemerias I ever met back when I was a teenager at an estate in La Jolla, California. There was a bed about 30 feet long of these amazing Peruvian lilies. And it was the LIG2 hybrids, which were the only ones on the market at that time. It was a little nursery up there on Mount Soledad, if any of you know the La Jolla area. And the guy who ran the little nursery just grew them from seed. And I've done it. They're very, very easy. They take a while. Start the seed about the same time you start your, I don't know, your peppers in the late winter, early spring. Do them in a normal seed starting mix. They grow. They probably won't bloom till the second year, but it's a very nice color range of sort of pastel pink, salmon, purplish, white. It's the older color range. The stems are as much as 4 feet tall, so they cut absolutely great. They do spread by rhizomes and they will reseed somewhat as well. So if you don't want to go out and buy these fancy, yeah, what I'll tell you what they've done with the newer hybrids, amazing color range. You've got some true red finally. You've got some strong orange, stronger colors. These are were bred for the florist industry, true purple. Those are the ones you're going to pay a lot of money for, but you only need one. They divide quite easily. But if you are a cut flower person, if you do a, if you have a, let's say a cut flower business, I know people locally in Davis who are just working out of their homes, doing cut flowers and making arrangements for people. This would be a great addition to your border. And they look really nice too. They're informal, but they look great. So the LIG2, LIGTU hybrids, still sold by Park Seed Company, who introduced them 75 years ago, probably. And they're still out there and they're not expensive and they're easy to grow from seed. He had actually direct seeded them into this bed. But La Jolla's climate, you can do that. Okay. If this is on, any of you know San Diego, any of you know La Jolla, Mount Soledad is a little overstated. It's a hill, but it's the mount which overlooks La Jolla and faces west and gets a sea breeze and fog every morning. It's pretty easy to grow things from seed there. But in our climate, you would definitely want to start them in a greenhouse or in a shade house or something like that. But they're not difficult. And I urge gardeners who are trying to save money and grow something that's an amazing cut flower, just look at that. It would be on my list of 10 top perennials for easy cultivation, low cost, and cut flowers. It would definitely be up there. Penstemon Midnight would be another one. We could That'd be a whole show right there. I Maybe we'll do
Let's do that. Don, let's
it.
do that show.
Easy
Yeah,
flowers for cutting.
maybe beginning of August when people are looking at the seed catalogs for the winter.
Yeah, a lot of those things would start in the fall. I mean, there's many things. Boy, have we gotten off topic. There's many things that we start at our nursery in August to September for sale in September, October for people to plant for fall bloom or more commonly for bloom the next spring or summer. And the two that we're really looking at right now, just as an example, going back to your first question, are the old-fashioned snapdragons, the ones that are great for cutting, the UC hybrids, the Chantilly lace. There's a bunch of really cool long-stemmed snapdragons that people stopped growing years ago because they take so long. You know, you have to plant them in the fall and they don't bloom till next spring. And the other is hollyhocks, or not hollyhocks, excuse me, foxgloves, which are very, very easy to grow. They'll grow in the shade. They are poisonous. I need to put that out there before you jump up and down and go out and plant foxgloves. Be aware that it's digitalis. But there's a lot of different types, and you plant them in the fall for bloom next spring. Delphiniums, a bunch of other things like that. So it is actually an active planting period for us. Long ago, I found the gardening public, at least nowadays, doesn't know those plants, doesn't really grow them, but you don't know what you're missing. Sweet William, Dianthus barbatus, one of the most fragrant dianthus there is, but it's a biennial, so you have to plant it in the fall for bloom next spring. That's coming up just a few weeks from now. We promise to remind you. How's
Oh, we will remind you about so many things, and we will answer your questions. And right now, I have a question from Greg, who lives in Woodland. That's right near Davis. I have two questions, one about melons, one about an onion situation. On the melon front, I have planted about 10 melon hills from late May to late June with everything from cantaloupe to watermelon to Asian melons, both from seed and transplants. However, they're very lackluster this year, barely growing. I did notice a few spotted cucumber beetles hanging out in the yard, but June has also been unseasonably cool. I'm pretty sure the soils and water are fine, as we are in the Reef YOLO fine sandy loam, and I have drip irrigation. I amend with lots of leaf mold and other compost 1 to 2 times a year. UCANR says that the spotted cucumber beetle is basically impossible to stop, and that its larval stage eats the roots of cucurbits. Are you hearing of this or having serious similar experience, or am I just being impatient? What's going on, Don?
Temperature is probably a big factor on this. The night temperatures, where we have several times over the last 3 to 4 weeks gotten down to 49, 50, 51, 52 degrees, which is cooler than a lot of these plants would be expecting in this time of year. That is slowing things down. Where there was an interesting commentary on the Sacramento blog, Sacramento Digs Gardening, written by Debbie Arrington, Sacramento Bee, formerly with the Sacramento Bee, about people reporting tomatoes ripening more slowly, melons developing more slowly. My own experience was that the melons I put in late May, early June, they continued to make leaf growth, but they didn't start that running across the ground thing that they do. If you've ever grown melons, it's like they're gearing up. And then they're taken off. First they creep and then they leap, as they say about many plants. And this in particular is a characteristic of melons and pumpkins and things like that. But you plant them and they put some new leaves out and then they run across the ground. They really didn't start until about 2 or 3 weeks later than my normal calendar would indicate. And that's almost certainly a night temperature, soil temperature phenomenon. So my guess is that's what you're seeing. Particularly watermelon. And some of the, muskmelons, the others are actually doing the same thing. Pumpkins, by comparison, just hit the ground running and they're doing great. They don't care. Think about the places they grow giant pumpkins. Nova Scotia, not exactly like Sacramento Valley temperatures, but watermelon is a tropical plant. Muskmelons aren't as needy in terms of temperature, but they're up there. So that's part of what you're seeing. And if we continue this way, I don't think anyone's going to complain, but if we continue this way, it may delay ripening. What I do when I plant a watermelon is I take a picture of the label and then I mark my calendar. I look at the label and it says 82 days, and I go out 82 days on my calendar and I mark it with that variety with a question mark as to whether it's ripe then, because it's really hard to tell if watermelons are ripe. They always look ripe 10 to 14 days before they really are. So I want to make sure I don't harvest too early. My guess is that'll be a little bit of an underestimate this year. In other words, if it says 82 days, it may be closer to 90 simply because of the lower temperatures we've had here. I'm not absolutely sure about that. We can certainly catch up, I guess. But my assumption is that that's the problem you're seeing. Cucumber beetles can be very, very frustrating. They migrate through my yard periodically and then they tend to disappear, but they can do a lot of damage while they're present, mostly to the leaves. And although I've read about this injury to the roots and such, I haven't typically seen that myself. I do find that on my property, I have such a large population of my friendly mockingbirds and scrub jays that almost any beetle problem that shows up disappears very quickly. And so my best suggestion to you would be to do whatever you can. This will be Lois's department in a moment, to encourage scrub jays and mockingbirds, because they are unbelievably effective pest control for these larger pests. They immediately take out any red hump caterpillars on your cherries and walnuts and red buds. They will take off leaf-footed bugs, which are on your pomegranates and on your tomatoes, on your peaches. They will take the stink bugs that most other things probably wouldn't eat. And you can watch them doing it. So it may not be the simplest thing to do, but bringing those two species into your yard in any manner you can has been very effective for me. I'm on a farm, so it's pretty easy to provide them the cover and the moisture and so forth that they need. But for a backyard gardener, how would you get mockingbirds and particularly scrub jays in there?
So, mockingbirds are not attracted to anything that humans put out as far as bird seed kinds of situations. Mockingbirds just will be in the area or not be in the area, depending upon what the area is like. I'm assuming that if he's in woodland, he's probably in residential area, though he's talking about a lot of stuff, so maybe he's on the outskirts. However it is, you can attract scrub jays. Now, scrub jays will come if you put out a normal feeder with chopped sunflower seeds, which is what I always put out because they don't grow. And the little birds will love it, and the scrub jays will come and they'll go, and ew, this is just not worth it, and they'll leave. But if you put out some unsalted, unroasted peanuts.
Okay.
Oh, the scrub jays will go, ooh, what's this? And they really like peanuts. So make sure you're not putting out salted or roasted ones. But you know,
Okay.
you can buy raw peanuts in the shell, and that's fine. So if you get someplace near where your problem is, and you can put like, you know, a little a stool out there with a couple of nuts on top of it or something like that. So they can see it, and they can come and they go, oh, that's nice. Well, once they've had something to eat in that spot, they will come and check it out periodically. And so if they come, even if there's no peanuts left, they'll be in the area and they might notice that you have, ooh, there's some beetles I can eat. So that's the best I can do as far as encouraging scrub jays. The other thing to say is if you have cats that are roaming around your yard, don't do this because you do not want the scrub jays out there getting caught by the cats.
Okay. And they are difficult to control. People often want to know if there's some spray they can use. Generally speaking, with beetles, the answer is just going to be no. There aren't really effective remedies, even if you wanted to go the route of an insecticide, because they're very, very hard to kill. You'd literally just have to spray them. You might as well just squish them if you're standing there, spray them directly. And the sprays that you would be using are not things that most home gardeners are really going to want to use. They do make comments in at the UCANR site for farmers, and I've noticed this myself. They do not like heat. And so mulching, unfortunately, can encourage cucumber beetles. Leaving open soil can discourage them. When we first started farming on this property, we rototilled, as everybody did in those days, and made perfectly smooth soil. And then we would plant pumpkins and we would mulch with straw like crazy. And the pumpkins, the first couple of years we did them, we had alfalfa nearby and we had sugar beet farms nearby. This was a long time ago. Sugar beets haven't been grown in this area for like a couple of decades. And we had a massive problem with cucumber beetles. I mean, they were really a big problem, as were various other beetles. And we were talking to an old farmer and he said, no, you got to make it like it's the Sahara Desert between the plants. I said, what? No mulch, till the soil. They make it so they can't crawl and they don't want to hang out there because it's too hot. But, well, that's not really my training or anything, but I'll give it a try. And you know what? It worked. Keeping it completely open between the plants, especially in the early part of the season, made a big difference. It just the next year, at least, I'm just, again, correlation and causation, all that stuff we've talked about before. I can't say it was an absolute direct relationship between the way we changed our pattern, but we did stop mulching with straw around them. I'm a big fan of straw mulch, but when we had a problem, we pulled it back, we left it open, we cultivated, we got the weeds out of there. That's really important, particularly for harlequin bugs, which are another problem people are having right now. But cucumber beetles tend to like the same plants. So getting the mustard plants out of there and keeping it just open and bare if you're having a problem with them. In general, mulching is a great thing to do. It helps conserve moisture, it helps shade the soil and so forth. Unfortunately, it can encourage certain pest problems. So if you've had a problem with cucumber beetles, you might pull the mulch away. And beyond that, it's just a matter of getting something in there that's going to eat them. My experience is, and they would typically move on. They do a lot of damage and then move on. So it's not something where you have an ongoing problem all summer. Watch for them early in the season. And that's when having the open areas around the plant probably makes more difference than anything. Hope that helps. They're very challenging, but a lot of what we're seeing with the slower ripening, the slower development, is just temperature related. We're gardening in a slightly different climate this year than we're accustomed to.
Okay, Craig writes, I typically plant onion seedlings in November as soon as the nursery gets them into stock. I have noticed that the red burger variety comes out in May, while Italian torpedo onions can be slower, coming out in late June. I think he means getting big enough to use when he
The
says
harvest,
coming out.
yes, right, yep.
Yeah. I have never rotated beds as the allium bed is located for good sun in the winter. During the summer, they get sun until 4 p.m. when a phalanx of sun chokes and grapes shade the bed up.
Okay.
I love that
Yes,
phrase. Is this
right.
fellow a philosopher? Yeah. My question is what to do with the beds over summer. Typically, I just mulch with leaves and let it sit until fall. I was wondering if there isn't a better system to consider, such as a cover crop, better compost mix, or even starting a bed rotation with fall brassicas. I have not seen any diseases in these beds yet, so I haven't seen the need to rotate, but I have new beds now that will work for alliums. I am open to suggestions. So remember, Greg is in Woodland.
Yeah,
What
now,
can he?
yeah, Woodland is basically the same climate as us. It's the same USDA zone, slightly different sunset zone, but we all talk the same in terms of garden vegetables and that kind of thing. There are summer cover crops, although not nearly as many as we have in terms of choices for winter cover crops. Summer cover crops are cowpeas, which most people know better by the name black-eyed peas. Some people know Crowder peas. Those are all a summer growing pea. You can eat them, but they're mainly grown for their deep roots and the fact that they run out of the soil, cover the soil, help to shade it, which helps to crowd out weeds, and they also fix nitrogen. You can also do buckwheat, and I'm not talking about the native buckwheat shrub. I'm talking about the annual buckwheat crop that's used as a essentially as a grain. It comes up very quickly, makes a very fast amount of biomass. Flowers, when it flowers, you should mow it off because if you don't, it'll reseed, and like vetch, you'll have buckwheat everywhere. I can think of worse problems, but it's a very, very rapid cover crop. I have stocked buckwheat seed off and on for years. If two or three people actually come in and buy it, I'm amazed because nobody knows summer cover crops or uses them, but they're really useful. They're really great. And buckwheat is a really good one because it'll cover quickly, even in light shade, like you're describing from the grapes and the what was it? Sunchokes. Sunchokes are going to fill that bed if you aren't careful, as you probably know. Jerusalem artichokes, yeah, those will spread quite a bit. So keep your eye on those. You could also plant things like basil. I mean, there are summer herbs that will grow there, and basil is certainly one that light shade is okay with basil, better flavor in sun, but perfectly good in grown in partial shade. Mulching it heavily in midsummer with stuff like compost and leaves is great because that gets it ready for the fall vegetables. Those are all options, and I think you're on the right track. More to the point, you can start early planting of those fall vegetables. Onions go particularly well in our area. Now, this is a very regional answer because there's places where people will be scratching their heads at this. Harvested onions are a great rotation with brassicas for us because the first of the brassicas, by which I mean, of course, the cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, all that crowd, the first of them really should go in the ground here in August. And it's really hard to persuade people of that. I've always stocked six packs and singles of Brussels sprouts in my nursery starting in late July, and I end up taking them home because nobody buys them because it's summer. Nobody's thinking of those things at this time, but that is when you plant them. So if you've always wanted to grow Brussels sprouts, now I'm a little concerned about the shade part of it, but with some strategic pruning, you could probably get your Brussels sprouts, your Romanesco, some of the old-fashioned larger-headed cauliflowers. You could get them going and put them in the sunnier end of the bed, perhaps. Give it a try because I suspect you'll find that that combination, late-harvested onions and early planted brassicas, may work very well for you. I've even stuck in a tomato plant midsummer and had it do well. Again, I don't know if you have enough sun for that. So that would be a question. Again, some strategic pruning might be necessary. And increasingly, this is interesting, I have more and more customers buying peppers, pepper plants, sweet peppers, green peppers, hot peppers, all through the summer, partly because their heavy crop, especially the hotter peppers, is in the fall. My own experience, I always grow hatch peppers, for example. I plant them as late as end of June. I'm mainly harvesting them late September, early October, or even all the way into November. And many of them hang on there just fine, even into December. Lots of people finding that pepper plants are getting through the winter. People growing pepper plants as if they were perennial because you cover them or you put them in a pot and pull them closer to the house. You can actually get them to go through the winter more successfully than perhaps we were able to do 20, 30, 40 years ago. So that's a thought. And peppers are okay in light shade. So again, you'd have to evaluate this bed for whether you have enough sun for any of the things I'm talking about. But just plain mulching it. And this is something I really recommend everybody think about for any place that is just bare soil, is to just put stuff on it. Open soil, exposed to the sun, baking in the sun here, unirrigated, you're essentially killing that soil. I mean, the soil biota, as we call it, the microbes that are in there slowly die out. There's no roots for them to grow on. There's nothing breaking down organic material. You're just turning this lovely native soil that we have here into a hard-packed surface. You can improve that readily by mulching. And you can buy whatever cheap stuff you see at the hardware store. You can buy the good stuff. You should do all of those. You should make your own compost. You've got leaves. You've taken out the onions and you've trimmed off the foliage or whatever. You can put that out there. I mean, Ruth Stout was a famous gardening guru from the mid-20th century who popularized the idea of heavy mulching for her no-fuss gardening. I can't remember exactly what she called it, but it was the easiest form of gardening you could imagine. Mulch everything all the time. and her comments were things like, if it doesn't look trashy, you aren't doing it right. You know, she was she wanted you to understand all that leafy debris should go back into the soil. So just put, you know, if you aren't making a formal compost pile, at least just pile it up over there. And in our climate, Ruth was in Vermont. In our climate, water it because that'll help it to break down. But you know, a bag of the cheap compost they're selling at the hardware store that has nothing added, that's just compost, okay, fine. A bag of the really enriched stuff that nurseries like mine sell, yeah, get some of that in there so you get that nitrogen there as well. But just keep a couple inches of stuff on the surface. We'll give the one little note. Remember those ground-dwelling bees that need a little attention, so leave some spaces unmulched for them to make their little habitat. But in general, leafy stuff, vegetative material just put on the ground and watered will make a big difference. And of course, packaged compost materials if you don't happen to have your own compost pile. If you have your own compost pile, it's important to keep it watered. Okay. In our climate, it dries out pretty quickly. And if that's becoming a hassle, I mean, someone gave us a giant compost bin years ago and we tried to use it, but we just found we weren't getting around to it. So we just took all the stuff that was in it and spread it out on the ground. You know what? That worked great. So your compost became mulch. And then in the process of being mulch, it turned into compost. Amazing.
So the little bare soil spots that we want to leave for the bees, it's okay to have that in a shady area, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't have to be full sun for the bees.
Nope. That's just some reasonably loose soil that is with irrigation nearby. I've noticed this on my farm. The longhorn bees, the digger bees, and the others, they're always in a place where I'm irrigating nearby. And there's lots of cover. I mean, there's some of the one of the plants I find them on is this big area of lavender that's a solid thicket of lavender. The females are near there in some relatively loose soil. There's a drip system in there that provides some moisture. You know, they want the basics of living, but they don't have to have the whole area open. You don't have to have a leave a large area for these ground-dwelling bees. You just have to remember if we're all telling you, get arborist wood chips delivered, you now have 15 yards, bury your yard in a foot of arborist wood chips like Lois did. Leave one little corner for the bees, okay? Because that's what they need.
So that then we go to the next question, and this is from Ken, and Ken is in Palo Alto. There we go. All right. He said, I took your advice and did not do any trimming on my tomato plants, usually using my usual philosophy of benign neglect on my tomato plants. So you're welcome. I'm glad you enjoyed our thing. Okay. His message says, Hi, Don and Lois. I need help from you on how to stop these clover-like weeds from invading my lawn. As per your suggestion, I did get a new lawnmower and I'm cutting the lawn to only 3 inches, only using alfalfa pellets and mulching. I hate to use any type of chemical solutions. Are there any suggestions for getting rid of these clover-like weeds? And then I'm looking at the pictures. Whoops, pictures of clover-like. So I'm not sure. It looks like it's got three leaves on the plant that's in there, which means it's not a grass. So why couldn't you spray it with one of those, kill the dicots but not the monocots? Oh, wait a minute.
You don't want to use
He doesn't
that.
like pesticides, do him.
Right. This is a
Okay.
broadleaf weed killer, would probably do this. What this is oxalis. It's not the oxalis we talked about 3 months ago, which was the oxalis pes capra or Bermuda buttercup, which is naturalizing all over Mediterranean climate regions of the world, including California. That's the one that has it stands up a foot tall. Kids call it sour grass because there's oxalic acid in it, and you can bite the stem of the flower. Now that's done. That's actually gone now. You think it's gone dormant now? This is the oxalis that invades lawns, and it's the ground covering creeping type. This is a tough one. It has two characteristics that make it very difficult. It comes up both from seed and from the stem, so it comes up both from seed and vegetatively. So that can be an issue. The fact that you have to do two different methods of control if you're using, even if you're using herbicides for it. So that's the first thing, and the other is that it explodes its seeds. So it flowers and has these sets these little pods, and under certain temperature conditions, they kind of burst open. So the seed flies 3, 4, 5, 6 feet away. and lands on some bare soil. What's interesting about this picture is that these are on the edge of his turf right near the path. And these seeds could probably not have germinated in the turf portion itself because of the density of the turf. So that's the key strategy here. They sprouted in an area of open soil. And in general, almost all weeds that you're dealing with in your lawn are going to be opportunists. They're going to come in where there are bare areas and they're going to seed in there. And then in the case of this one, they spread out through the turf by these rhizome-like runners. And those can root as they go to some degree, and they can also sprout back from those. But the main issue is dealing with the seed crop and the seed germination of this particular type of oxalis. Yes, there are broadleaf weed killers of the many brands out there. They're all basically the same active ingredient, which is Trimec. They kill non-grass plants in grass lawns, and they've been popular for years. The Weed and Feed products, which we excoriated last week, will be labeled for this weed, but they don't work well on it. And the reason being, even if you're thinking of using these, the reason being they count on a granule of this fertilizer weed or killer product sitting on the leaflet long enough to be absorbed. These are small leaflets, and so it's very hit or miss as to whether you actually get reasonable distribution. The efficacy is poor. So in the long run, you want to avoid having any bare areas. Be especially vigilant on the edges of your turf and if you have a mound, on the top of the mound, because those are the areas that tend to thin out, in part because they tend to dry out faster, in part because of traffic or because of people scalping them. One of the most common issues I see with folks who have a commercial lawn service is they'll come along and their mower goes on the edge of the lawn, which tends to drop down a little bit, and they scalp the edge, which is already stressed because it's the worst area in terms of sprinkler distribution. You generally don't have really good water coverage on the edges and corners. So you have a stressed area, cut too low, thins out, open soil is an invitation to weed seeds, and they will germinate there. These guys come up, oxalis comes up in March, sprouts in March. So the other option, which you might look into if you're okay with it, is using a pre-emergent herbicide you put on before they germinate. But in general, your best bet is to make sure there's no bare soil, get as thick a turf as you can, and you do have a nice density to your turf further in where it's trying to invade. Taking a rake and just raking out the leaves to just stress the weed as much as possible. But the main issue is that you still do have some areas where the seedlings can germinate, and that's what you want to focus on. Instead of worrying about spraying to kill the existing plants, work to make a less conducive environment for the seedlings to germinate. That would really be what I'd come down to. I think you'll see this problem diminish significantly because you're now mowing at 3 inches. You have good density to your turf, and it looks like a fine fescue, which really does crowd out weeds very effectively when it's well established.
Looking at the picture that he has, the one that has his foot in it,
Yep.
you can see the edge of the whatever he's standing on, and then some bare dirt, and then this stand of weeds, and then a nice lawn. So what I'm wondering is, it looks to me, if I took a string trimmer and I cut down the weeds, raked them out, and then seeded that heavily with new grass seed and got that going right next to the sidewalk. Would that help?
Yeah, seeding into that area is going to make a big difference. You might as well wait until it's cooler weather to do that. So the time to really work on getting your lawn density increased is as we go into, in our climate, October, November, coastal zones where he is, you can do it as early as September. And I also want to mention the top of the mound thing because I've run into that so many times back when I was troubleshooting lawns, is that no lawn sprinkler system is perfect. And so we want 50% or so overlap between the sprinkler heads, but that's never perfect. It never is exactly that way. That's one of the reasons I do highly recommend at some point set out your tuna cans in different places, and especially the part of the lawn that's always had more weeds in it or had less density of the turf, and see what the distribution of your sprinklers actually is. And the top of a mound where the water tends to drain away usually is getting less water because of the design. You may need to do a little augmenting of that. Set a little sprinkler out there, run it longer periodically. Sprinkler design is not perfect. Sprinkler overlap is never perfect. And the corners, edges, and the tops of the mounds or the slopes tend to be more problematic.
Oh, all right. Here's another listener who writes in. This is from Diane. Hi, Don. I hope all is good. I'm working on a new plan in East Sacramento, and I need to plant under a huge cedar. I think it's a deodar cedar. It has large roots, surface roots. What plants work under the tree, and what do I need to be concerned with? It is a bit shady, but I need to check at various times of the day to see what the sun is doing. Thank you. And there's a picture here. I can see that there's a road and then a narrow sidewalk, concrete sidewalk, then this tree with a fairly large amount of area around it. It's not one of those little tree wells that's 2 feet across or something. And then on the building side, there are some slabs making a secondary pathway.
Yeah, and these are always challenging environments when it's just the narrow strip next to the street. We've taken to calling those the sidewalk hell strip because they're usually unirrigated. They're very hot. There's a lot of foot traffic. People even drive over them occasionally. But this is a lot wider than that. This is actually a big planter area in an urban setting. Urban settings have some specific issues. First of all, the first question I would ask if I were doing this project or just evaluate on site, what's the irrigation and what's it, you know, what is the irrigation system? Is there one? And how's it going to be managed? Because that's going to dictate your plant choices to some degree. But I note that one of the plants here appears to be sword fern. And sword fern, the southern sword fern is a tough plant, but it can't live without irrigation. So obviously, someone's been watering this bed at some point, at least up until now.
And the cedar tree has grown huge. I mean, we're just seeing the trunk of it here, but that is bigger than any cedar tree I've ever seen.
Oh, deodar cedars are very, very, very large trees. I mean, I planted one when my kid was born, and that tree is about 50 feet tall and 40 to 50 feet across. Now, I've allowed the lower branches to stay, so I have considerable shade under mine. There's litter from them. You don't need to worry about the litter. That's not going to harm the soil in any way. I get that question a lot. Are the needles a problem? No, the needles are fine if you can possibly leave them. But it's a year-round shade as opposed to a deciduous tree, so you even have shade in the wintertime. As noted in her comment, you will need to look and see, does the late afternoon sun come in here? It would be an important thing to know if you've got a 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock summer sun coming into this bed. Well, that'll certainly determine which types of plants you're going to choose in there. I see there's rocks and things that have been put in there, and that's actually a useful thing to do because it reduces through traffic. When you put rocks into a planting like this, it keeps people from just walking straight through. So the rocks should stay where they are or be rearranged in such a way as to manage traffic flow to some degree. And then the other question is, what is the traffic in this area? If it's some of the ornamental grasses work very well. Deer grass is a good example. It's a big grass. So a few grasses would be a possibility. Now, I mentioned not using thorny plants, but at times they're very useful. There's some plantings that were done downtown in Davis around trees where they're having a problem with massive compaction and everybody just parking their bikes on the spot. And, you know, the soil had turned into like rock hard stuff. They planted roses. What? And I had someone was saying, they planted roses. Can you believe that? Thorns. And I said, yeah, thorns. Okay, in that particular setting, you're protecting the tree by planting roses around it. So there is a place for perhaps some of the landscape roses that might be tolerant of shade. Bonica is a good example, something really disease resistant. What I've been using in places where we have traffic on a sidewalk, and we just need a low-growing plant. There are some grassy plants that I have used. Acorus is a good example. Acorus ogon, which has golden foliage and can take standing water or drought. It's one of those plants. Just takes almost anything. An edge of that along where these new steps have been poured would soften them up and be something that would be attractive, give some colorful foliage, and could tolerate occasionally being stepped on. Some of the fescues, some of the native fescues, these are soft-looking plants. These are like the red fescue that's used in turf, but some of them have silver foliage. Some of them have shiny green. Green foliage. You would typically buy them in 3-inch pots or quart pots and plant them out like a ground cover. You're not going to do these from seed. You're not going to seed anything out in a public area like this anyway. It just wouldn't work. But you're going to plant these on, say, 2 to 3 foot centers, and they will spread and they'll make an informal meadow-like look. And they're very attractive. They've got the fine foliage of the creeping red fescue with either dark green, silver gray, or really, really light gray. It's some of the newer forms. So these are ones you can look for that will be planted out like perennials, even though they're using them as if they were a grassy meadow. So they can go along the edge to soften the strong geometry of those step stones. And if they get stepped on, they'll come back up. This is one of the reasons things like daylilies have been so popular in these kinds of plantings, particularly the dwarf ones like Stella Doro, which blooms literally year round. It only grows a foot, It blooms like crazy. It's got yellow flowers all the time. And if you happen to step on it, it just pops right back up and regrows. So that's an effective one. I will tell you one thing we used in an area on a retirement home where we had a problem with people just walking right across a bed and it was in a lot of shade, is we just filled it with Mahonia aquifolium, which is our Oregon grape, California Oregon grape. Mahonias have now been moved to Burberry, which is unfortunate, but they're not thorny like Barberry, but the leaves are spiny, so they're scratchy. So people stopped walking through the beds right away when we planted those in there. It was very effective. I would use the compact form, Mahonia aquifolium compacta, because it's the nicest looking garden plant. You're not going to get hurt, but you won't go through there again. So it's the kind of thing that you'll feel it when you walk into it, but you're not going to be pulling spines out of yourself or anything like that. And it's tolerant of sun or shade. It's one of those real workhorse natives. I mean, it fits in almost any setting. They just don't sell super well. And part of the reason is that they bloom midwinter when people aren't really out there doing things. Well, that's a big feature to me. I mean, the fact that you have a bright yellow flower in the middle of the winter. And most of the Mahonias start blooming in late December. I have pictures of them in the month of January, in full bloom, drawing beneficials at a time when not much else is going on. Little berries that follow, which are technically edible. Birds like them. That's a great plant. It just is one of those, I don't know, it's so basic that people don't use it that much. But a grouping of Mahonia aquifolium compacta would be really worth considering in here. And if the people you're working with are interested in natives, and you wanted to throw in a couple other things that are almost sure to work. Ribes viburnifolium, we mention this one all the time. It's the evergreen currant, evergreen ribes, hugs the ground. Find one place for one and let it spread 4 or 5 feet. You're not going to, don't do a mass planting of it, but it's really pretty, clean looking plant. The blooms are tiny, but profuse enough and visible enough to hummingbirds that they're very attracted to it. So, Ribes viburnifolium, ground covering form of Ribes. A non-native plant that has a very similar growth habit is the Australian fuchsia, Corea pulchella. Also blooms in the winter. So you get some bloom in the late winter and into the spring on that one, and scattered bloom at different times of year. Again, very tolerant of sun or a fair bit of shade. So a very adaptable plant. Those are the woody spreading plants, which if they get stepped on, you cut them back, they resprout, and everything is fine. So consider some of those. But again, not a mass planting. If I could get designers to stop taking 30 of one thing and putting them in on a grid pattern, I would feel I've accomplished a lot. Two to three of them with a grass nearby and some rocks, and then some bulbs. Don't forget some bulbs in there to give some bloom at their season. And then, cyclamen or dwarf narcissus, which will come up and bloom for years and years and years all on their own. So keep some of those things in mind as well. But the woody plants that'll hold their own, these slightly scratchy plants, and then these kind of edging plants like the acorus and the grasses to soften the strong geometry of those steps that were poured.
So we end the show as usual with a garden saying, and this one is from Gertrude Jekyll from the
I
1800s.
know who Gertrude Jekyll is, probably one of the most famous garden designers of all time.
A garden is a grand teacher. It teaches patience and carefulness, watchfulness. It teaches industry and thrift. Above all, it teaches entire trust.
Wow. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.